Should I start? Give it a second. Max, would you like me to start or wait a second?
You say.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm about a foot short for the tuck, and I don't play the fiddle, but we will start with Chris Casella.
Okay, great. Well, Dan and I were charged with talking about the effects of early environments in critical periods. And the subtitle of our talk is The Long Reach of History. This is before we knew we were going to be in a session called The Long Arm of Childhood. And in a lot of ways, the differences between those two titles is the punchline of our talk. I think that biodemography has really embraced the idea that our adult health traces back to our early life experiences, going back to childhood, going back to the prenatal environment. What we'd like to talk about today is some newer evidence that our health also traces back to environments experienced by ancestors, going back multiple generations through various pathways. And so this idea, at the roots of adult health tracing part to experiences during early life, David Barker gets a lot of credit for this. He passed away, sadly, at the end of last year. He was inspired by findings like these here in the UK, showing higher rates of coronary heart disease among lower birth weight individuals, probably familiar to everybody here. From this, he proposed a model that's pretty much stood the test of time. A lower resource fetus, lower nutrition or stressed, will slow its growth rate as a way to conserve resources, but which we've known for a long time, but now we know that there are many other changes biologically that are also occurring that are durable, persistent to later life, and increase long-term health risks. Now, a lot of this research has been observational in humans. A lot of it's problematic, inferring causality from things like birth weight. But animal model work has been very important in establishing some of the mechanisms and establishing causality. So here you see in guinea pigs, these open circles here are individuals whose mothers had their diet restricted by 30% during pregnancy. See that they have higher fasting insulin in this range here, and then they have a bigger insulin response to a glucose challenge. This shows that they're insulin resistant, that is on the way to becoming a diabetic. Right, so that's an experimental insight into a finding such as this, which is observational in humans. When you see this kind of finding, the animal model data gives us some assurance that there's actually something about fetal nutrition that's driving these kinds of relationships. Now, this paradigm has, of course, inspired a lot of good biodemographic work. I'll just give a couple examples of that. First, mechanisms. What are the mechanisms? The first is very simply changes in developmental biology. So changes in organ structure, growth, kidneys, et cetera, these things regulate physiology in ways that can influence health. But increasingly, there's more and more emphasis on, epigenetic factors. And just a super quick overview of some of the key ones. Over here, now these are changes in the chromosomes that leave the DNA intact but modify gene expression. And one of those is histone modification. You can see that here the chromatin is less tightly packed so that the cell can get access to that gene, whereas it can't here. Methylation involves the attachment of a methyl group in the vicinity of a gene, and then suppressing gene transcription. And then there are all kinds of effects of non-coding RNA that can influence, for instance, post-translational effects and protein production and so forth. So some good biodemographic work that's come out of this paradigm, just a couple of examples. Here you see that in the northern hemisphere, in Denmark and Austria, adult mortality relates to season of birth in a fashion that is 6 months out of phase with in Australia, in the southern hemisphere, really suggesting that there's an effect of season of birth long term. Here you see that if your mother was fasting during Ramadan 9 months prior to birth, that is around the time of conception, more likely to have disabilities long term. So this kind of work has complemented the mechanistic work, the human epidemiology work, and kind of moved us towards a more of a causal model in the human literature. And really, I think, enhanced appreciation for the long term effects of our own early life experiences. But again, as I alluded to, what we'd like to talk about today is moving beyond, kind of transcending the life course and thinking about evidence now for long-term effects of prior ancestral environments on the present generation. And we have evidence now for a variety of different pathways okay, potentially going back multiple generations. And some of these are epigenetic, some of them are developmental. We'll talk about those in the course of the talk. Testing these pathways is unusually challenging for a range of reasons that I'll discuss. And I think that those challenges really make demographers, in particular, very well suited to trying to move this field forward. And so we're going to talk about three different pathways today. We're going to talk about phenotype to phenotype transmission. And then number two, we're going to talk about germline epigenetic inheritance, these examples. And then three, something that might be new to many of you, plasticity and telomere length. Very exciting research here. And then a few concluding points. So let's start with pathway number one, phenotype to phenotype. These are really a very simple extension of the Barker hypothesis model. Right? So if your mother is experiencing nutritional or psychosocial stress while she's pregnant, this influences your health long term, things like your cortisol levels, your blood pressure, your fasting glucose levels as an adult. Okay. Now, all of those factors in turn influence the gestational environment of the next generation. So that you have the potential here for a multi-generational effect. And so one simple example of that is that if you're lower birth weight, you're more likely to become hypertensive later in life. That's pretty well established now. But if you're hypertensive going into pregnancy, you're more likely to give birth to a growth-restricted fetus, okay, so who in turn will have the same sort of health consequences long-term as you did. The Barker scenario is really about lower birth weight and fetal and undernutrition as a driver of risk, but there's also risk associated with being too large and fetal overnutrition. And this is increasingly a problem here in the United States. So if your mother is diabetic and obese, or I should say diabetic because she's obese during pregnancy, her glucose levels are high. This increases delivery of glucose to the fetus. You get a macrosomic baby who has more body fat and changed metabolism in a way that increases their risk for obesity and diabetes themselves, increasing the likelihood that they will, in turn, if female, be a diabetic mother, and then the cycle continues, right? There's a lot of evidence for this kind of effect in humans. We see an excess in heritability through the Matcher line, for instance, for these conditions. And there are great sibling comparisons that I think are very compelling. So here we see that siblings born after an obese mother went through gastric bypass surgery to lose weight, right? Big weight losses. You see that they are much lighter, they have lower waist circumference and much less body fat compared to their siblings born prior to the gastric bypass surgery. You also see big improvements in things like insulin resistance, insulin, and lipid profiles. Now, there are potential confounds, parity effects, and so forth, but I think this is pretty good evidence that there's a causal role of the gestational environment itself in perpetuating these conditions. Okay, so this leads to an interesting question about how a condition like this might look in a population through time. So a classic gene environment interaction kind of scenario, you start as an offspring at the top in white, you inherit your genome from your parents, and then your phenotype is modified by your lifetime of experience of the environment. So think of that as something like weight gain and metabolic dysregulation, that increasingly blue color. The next generation resets, right? They inherit the same genes, or more or less similar genes, and they start over. They interact with that same environment, and through time, this clicker's not working. There we go. Through time, you're getting a reset, so each generation looks similar. Now, the example that I just gave of gestational diabetes and obesity, you're inheriting more from your parents than just your genome, right? You're also inheriting part of the effects of their phenotype and their collective experience across their life cycle. And so in that scenario, there we go. You can see the starting point here has been modified by the mother's experience. And so you get modifications on a different baseline in each generation, potentially amplifying the phenotype through time. And so when we think about a condition like obesity, what is its true character within the population? Is it this kind of scenario here on the left, or is it more of an amplification? And I think conditions related to the microbiome would also plug into this right category, because it's modified by experience across the life course and also passed on to the next generation birth. Okay, so those are examples of phenotype to phenotype transmission. I'm going to build a basic pedigree diagram for the various pathways to illustrate them. So here we have a female offspring, mother, father, grandparents. So what we just described, the Barker scenario, is this right here. It's the mother's effect on the offspring. And we now know that the mother's effect on the offspring is in part shaped by her own development and the grandmother's experience. So we can extend that back, and we can ask the question of whether it goes back even further, as is in the examples of obesity and so forth that can perpetuate. All right, so that's examples of pathway number one. Let's go on to pathway number two. These are different. These do not involve a modification of the body that influences development in the next generation. These involve changes in the epigenetic state in germ cells that are passed on to the next generation through sperm or egg. It's a very different pathway of inheritance. And start with a simple example to illustrate this. When a pregnant mother is exposed to stress, there are three generations exposed to that stress, or to nutrition, or whatever it is. The mother, the fetus, and then the germ cells in the fetus who will become the grand offspring. All right? And those germ cells can be modified epigenetically, and that can be passed on to the grand offspring. Now, importantly, because we're talking about germ cells here, there's no gestational, talking about the passing of germ cells between generations, this can also happen through the patrilineage. So this could be a male fetus, and these could be sperm, that would be one way. And the other is an adult male could be exposed, and he and his sperm could be exposed, which would be exposing the offspring. And an example of that latter scenario we see in this mouse example here. Up here, there's a dietary intervention where males are fed on a low-protein diet, they're crossed with control animals, and down here, they look at gene expression. And here's what they find. So this is looking at methylation percentages in the vicinity of the PPAR alpha transcription factor. This is important in regulating lipid metabolism in the body. You see that the controls and the low protein animals, the offspring of the exposed animals, are, you know, you see these differences in methylation. This translates into differences in gene expression that are downstream of that related to lipid metabolism. And the punchline of all this is that the diet eaten by the adult males influence cholesterol levels in their offspring. Right? So there's no gestational transmission here at all. There's no effect of the organism's own early environment. It's purely an effect of the prior generation's experience and transmitted through sperm, as represented by this diagram here. Here's a more complex example, and this one involves stress. Right? So up here, these animals up here, after birth, were separated from their mothers to induce stress. That's the exposed animals. And then they looked at sperm in the adult offspring of the exposed to see if there were epigenetic changes in the germline. They then looked at neurons of the grand offspring of the exposed animal to see if those epigenetic changes are still present in the brains of those animals. And then they looked at behavior in the great grand offspring. And this is what they found. Up here you have the exposed, here you see the methylation differences in the vicinity of the cannabinoid receptor gene, not too important, but related to stress physiology and affect regulation. So that's in the adult offspring of the exposed animals and their sperm. Now you look in the neurons of the grand offspring of those animals, and you see the same methylation changes. They also found differences in transcripts, so it's actually influencing gene transcription. And then in generation three, we see differences in behavior in relation to kind of exploratory behavior and anxiety. Right? And here the punchline is that early rearing stress in newborn males influence behavior in their great grand offspring. So the environmental effect is perpetuating across three generations. And so here you have the exposed males, here are the three generations. Now, recall, if this animal here was exposed, they were exposed and also their sperm were exposed, which would become this generation. Notice that the phenotype is perpetuated for two generations beyond the exposed generation. So this is an example of true, what's called transgenerational germline epigenetic inheritance. It shows that the epigenetic marks take on a life of their own, and they transcend the generations that are exposed. So how long can this type of effect persist? Well, we don't know, but this is a mouse study in which pregnant rats were exposed to an endocrine disruptor, and you see differences in fertility across at least four generations of male offspring. And I say at least because they stopped looking. And they also looked in the mothers, in the matriline, I should say, and they followed that out three generations and found something similar. So this is an example where exposed mother here during pregnancy, four generations, and we see something similar through the matriline. Okay. All right, so these are mice and rats. This is where most of the evidence is. What do we know about germline epigenetic inheritance and how important it might be in humans? We know very little is the answer, unfortunately. And there are good reasons for that. No one is going to live long enough to design the 3 or 4 generation study prospectively to try to tease these relationships apart. So it's required creative use of historical data. And this is one example of that from Overkalix, Sweden, where they linked historical records of agricultural production to death records. And what they find is that favorable nutrition in late childhood increases adult mortality in grand offspring, whereas favorable nutrition in infancy decreases adult mortality in grand offspring. And the effects are sex-specific, so let me show you the actual findings. It's a little complex, but the red line are individuals who experience good nutrition at different ages. So if you experience good nutrition, the grandfathers, paternal grandfathers, they experience good nutrition in childhood, higher mortality, higher risk ratio for the grand offspring, grandsons, that is. If favorable nutrition early in life, it's the opposite. Right? And then if they look at paternal grandmothers, you see the same thing, but as a predictor of granddaughter's mortality risk. And then when they did the opposing cross, looking at paternal grandmothers as a predictor of grandsons, and paternal grandfathers as a predictor of granddaughters, there's basically flat lines. There's no association there. So the bottom line from this study, if it's actually showing us something causal, is that if you're female, your mortality is going to relate to the nutritional experiences of your paternal grandmother, and if you're male, your mortality is going to relate to the nutritional experiences of your paternal grandfather. The study is interesting. It's probably, they've shown this in sort of 2 of 3 cohorts that they've looked at. It's not been replicated beyond that. It'd be really nice if someone found a way to do that. All right, so that's pathway number 2, epigenetic changes that are transferred through sperm. Now let's look at something quite different from that. Look at telomeres. And this involves actual genetic plasticity. So this is changes in the nucleotide sequences themselves that are passed on to the next generation. A quick primer on telomeres. So these are repeating sequences of DNA that cap the ends of chromosomes. They're required for cell replication, and they get shorter with each cell replication. If they get short enough, the cell can no longer divide, and it's thought to contribute to aging and senescence. And this shows the age-related decline in telomere length in humans here. Individuals with shorter telomeres at baseline have higher mortality moving forward, and importantly, you really see this in infections. This is important because telomeres restrict cell proliferation. We only expect this to influence mortality through systems that require cell proliferation, like immunity. You wouldn't expect it in the brain or heart muscle cells or tissues that are not dividing. It should affect systems like immune function. Now, telomeres go down in age also because of stress and oxidative damage and all sorts of other factors, and so there's a lot of debate. Are telomeres really a cause of aging, or are they simply a marker of aging? There's a lot of kind of skepticism about them in some ways, but there is very good evidence, I think, for a causal role of telomeres, and this comes in the form of knockout mice, where you genetically modify telomere length and you look at outcomes in relation to that. When you do that, you see that they have genetically shorter telomere length mice have reduced stem cell mobilization proliferation, they have reduced hematopoietic and spleen cell proliferative capacity, which is important for immune function, they have poor wound healing, and they have much higher mortality, right? So this is, I think, pretty good evidence that there's a causal role. Now, given this scenario that I just laid out, that telomeres shorten with age and they drive aging through specific systems and pathways, there's a very interesting exception to this overall scenario. And that is that in sperm, telomeres actually get longer with age. And there's a reason for this. There's high expression of telomerase, which increases telomere length in testes. And of course, sperm are being produced across the life cycle of the adult male. And so you combine those and you get longer telomeres in the sperm of older men compared to younger men. What this implies is that the children of older fathers, okay, actually inherit longer telomeres. Now, there's been a lot of talk about how mutations can accumulate in older fathers, right, so you can higher risks of things like schizophrenia. But independent of that, you would expect as a result of this that offspring of older fathers are going to actually have more robust immune responses into later life, perhaps protection from cancer and things of that sort, potentially. That's one possibility. And my co-author on this paper, inspired by all this, wrote a wonderful paper in 2011 in which he proposed that longer telomere lengths in the offspring of older fathers could be an example of adaptive plasticity. And the logic is that investing more in somatic maintenance and lifespan extension could be adaptive if local demographic conditions favor or allow reproduction at later ages. If you're going to typically reproduce at a later age, invest more in somatic durability so that you can get there. The problem with this scenario, of course, is birth order effects. So if an older, you know, if a man has multiple kids and they're separated by 20 years, the firstborn and the lastborn are going to receive very different signals, right, as to those demographic conditions. And so the second part of the hypothesis is that paternal age of conception effects on telomere length will be not just across one generation, but they will accumulate across multiple generations. And this is a reasonable hypothesis because telomeres are nucleotide sequences. So if you pass on telomeres to your offspring, they're going to be copied with high fidelity, and they should, in theory, perpetuate down multiple generations. If this occurs, this would allow telomere length to be increased as the average age of reproduction is delayed consistently across multiple generations, and allow this kind of calibration of maintenance function to reproductive demographic conditions in the population. So, and just for more, you should really look at Dan's paper from American Journal of Human Biology in 2011. We also have a commentary in an International Journal of Epi from last year where we go into much more detail about this. So as a first step in testing this idea, does the paternal age of conception effect persist across two generations? It's already been shown that it goes across one. Does it start to accumulate across multiple? And the test for this was in Cebu, the Philippines, where I've been working for more than 15 years. And we have DNA here out in 2005, measured telomere lengths. And testing hypothesis one, we replicate the findings from other populations. Having an older father predicts longer telomeres in both the offspring generation and in the mother's generation. Right? And those effect sizes, importantly, are about this, you know, they're comparable to the yearly decline in telomeres that you see in the mother's generation. So they're actually, they seem to be biologically relevant and biologically important. And then on to hypothesis two, older age of grandfather's parents' conception will predict longer telomeres in the grand offspring. That is, there'll be a multi-generational effect. And we see evidence for that from the father's father to the grand offspring, similar effect size, but we see less of evidence for that from the mother's father to the grand offspring. And this was actually expected because mother to offspring, there's lower heritability of telomere length. So this is what the findings look like. Your father's age at your own conception, increase in telomere length. Your father's father's age at your father's conception, longer telomere length. And here's the combined effect of both of them, showing that this accumulates across generations. All right, so this suggests that if your father's older at your own conception, you have longer telomeres. If your grandfather was older at your father's conception, you have longer telomeres. And there's really no reason to think this isn't going to go farther back in time, potentially. We also have evidence, as I pointed out, that this male lineage here, that through your match line, there could be a weaker effect there. We're not sure. If we had a bigger sample size, would that be significant? We don't know. If it would be, then more males could be influencing this story across a bigger pedigree. But the bottom line here is that telomere length may evolve rapidly in response to changes in average age of reproduction in recent male ancestors. And this is interesting to think about in the context of the demographic transition. As reproduction is delayed, this could be contributing to enhanced function in late life. This is an idea we hope to test in Cebu. We have a proposal out to do that. So a few concluding points. Let's bring this all together, going fast here. This is the long reach of childhood, this blue line right here. This circle is the fetal origins Barker hypothesis scenario. We now know that we can extend that back to phenotype transmission to the prior generation and perhaps even the generation prior to that. We saw evidence that the father's diet can influence cholesterol levels here. The overcalix findings that paternal grandparents influence mortality here. Evidence for transgenerational epigenetic inheritance that could perpetuate across multiple generations, at least in mice and rats. And then finally, these ideas about telomeres going back multiple generations as well. All of these ideas point to one core punchline, and that is the long reach of history. Adult health is linked not only to one's own early environments, but also to the historical ancestor environments, to ancestral historical environments. And at a minimum, we're looking at complex lag effects of past environments on health in the present. The various pathways of potentially independent effects on health and collectively could be quite important. So, collectively, they could have a very large effect on aging rates. And we know almost nothing about the importance of these pathways in humans. I showed you the overcalix findings. The reason for that is simple, because they're really hard to study, because we're too long, you know, our lifespan is too long. And so the way to get around that is historical databases, census records, existing longitudinal cohorts, multi-generational cohorts. We have to use existing data. We're not going to live long enough to design the prospective studies to look at this. That's the kind of data that the folks in this room have. And the other problem, of course, is parallel inheritance of SES, shared environments, culture behavior. This is a massive confound, source of endogeneity. Selection bias is a big problem. So here, we can focus on exogenous shocks and ground our hypothesis tests and working models of the biology of critical periods. And I think that, you know, the folks who figured out the mechanisms in rodents are not going to be able to tell us how this works in humans. We cannot extrapolate from that life history and reproductive strategy to a species like us. It just is not going to work. So it's the folks in this room, the data that is represented in the statistical chops in this room that I think can move us forward in this field. And we hope to have some conversations over the next few days about that.
Reconvene at